and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And I think, to me, that little simple statement at the end, and there was light, says so much about that first chapter of Genesis. God said, let there be light. Well, there's light. You know, if God said, there are going to be fish in the sea, there are fish in the sea. You know, it shows His power. And when we look at His creation, we need to appreciate that. Genesis 12, 1 through 3, our second one. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. One of the things that I think is important as we grow in our study of the Bible and our knowledge is to begin to appreciate how it all fits together, how it things go together. And, you know, the stories of Genesis, so many of them, they can serve as what I would call standalone stories. I mean, you can study about, you know, certain things as great illustrations, like Genesis 22 that we'll be looking at tonight. As James would do in James 2, you can pull that story out and use it to illustrate how faith and works must go together. Or the story of Noah, great lessons about authority. But at the same time, it's important that we see this whole picture. And the story of Abraham is so critical to the story of the Bible. As he starts out down here in Ur, in, you know, southern Mesopotamia, you know, keep in mind, you know, here's your Tigris, here's your Euphrates River. Then he leaves there, he goes up to Haran, which comes back into the story again in chapter 24. You know, it seems that it's Abram, Lot, Terah that go there. But, and no mention of Nahor originally. But evidently he follows at some point and moves up there. And then of course God brings him into the land of Canaan where we see him now. We've been looking at the promises. Go make of him a great nation. Going to give to him this land of Canaan. And one day all the nations of the earth be blessed. Look at these numbers. Part of the reason I want you to appreciate these is really to develop a deeper appreciation for the faith of Abraham. And then by extension, that we learn to trust in God. You know, a lot of us, not all of you, I'm not going to accuse all of you, but I know I'm one who can be very impatient at times. What I want right now. And, you know, here is God calling Abraham even before he's 75. That's just the first age we're given. He enters Canaan. He goes 13 years without a child. Even though God is saying to him, I'm going to make this great nation out of you. Then he goes 13 more years thinking, okay, this is the promised child. And then God says, no. He's in the land of Canaan 25 years before the son of promise is born. But the son of promise has now been born. He's instituted the covenant of circumcision. And when we come to chapter 22, it has been some years. We don't know how many. This time we're not given a number. But it's been some time since God had spoken to Abraham, at least it was recorded. And when God speaks, it's one of those wow moments. He calls on Abraham, and look at the way it's said in verse 2. Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love. Well, Isaac's not technically the only son, is he? Well, Ishmael's been sent away. As far as the promises go, this is it. And I would never have picked up on this, but I read this and it's true. This is the first time the word love is used in the Bible. You know, that, and it's used of Abraham and his son. And he said, you take this son that you love and you go to the land of Moriah and you offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Some years have passed, and this is a man, remember chapter 15 verse 6, Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. You know, he's by faith, he's left his homeland. Now God says, let's test that faith and see how strong it really is. What does Abraham do in response to this? Look at verse 3 and you cannot help but be impressed. He rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey. He gets two young men and Isaac, and he splits the wood for the burnt offering, and he arose and went. Without any delay, he doesn't hesitate. But how long does it take him to get to the land of Moriah, to the mountain that God's going to show him? He arrives, it says, on that third day. You know, not only does he not delay, I would offer to you, they could have done this sacrifice anywhere. But by forcing him to go on a journey, it gives him plenty of time to rethink this thing. And go, wait a minute, I must have misunderstood. And the 3 days is interesting, not just as the test of Abraham's faith, a further test. The parallels are the similarities, at least, between this story and the story of Jesus. There's several of them. Jesus was in the grave for 3 days. Isaac was as good as dead for 3 days. I mean, when God said, you take him and offer him as a burnt offering, he's as good as dead for that period of time. But they come to the mountains of Moriah. Now, interestingly, where is the Temple of Solomon later built? Mount Moriah. And a great lesson has been taught about that significance, except that you notice what it says in verse 2, it says, the land of Moriah on one of the mountains. It is possible that the mountain that Isaac was taken up on is the same one the temple was later built on. But that's not a safe conclusion. But they get to this place. And look at verse 5. Abraham says to the young men, you stay here. The lad and I will go and worship and come back. And he says, we will come back to you. What does Hebrews 11 say that Abraham was confident that God would or could do? Raise him from the dead. And said in a figure, he received him back from the dead. Because he's dead. He's a dead man. When God gave that commandment, Abraham had every intention, but quite obviously, Abraham knows this is the promised son. So in his mind, it says, well, God must be going to raise him back up. That's not to minimize the faith, that's to maximize the faith of Abraham. He had never seen a 90-year-old woman give birth before. That's pretty amazing. He'd sure never seen a child have his throat cut and then be raised from the dead. But they start up the mountain, and what's the question that Isaac asks as they're going up the mountain? Yeah. We've got wood. We've got fire. Where's the sacrifice? And of course, Abraham said, the Lord will provide. The Lord will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. Now, I want you to think about something, and I know you already have probably. Who carries the wood up the mountain? Isaac, the one that's going to be offered. What does that say about the age of Isaac? He's not a little baby. I don't know how old he is, but he's old enough to carry enough wood to burn an offering. Now, did your mind run to another similarity? Jesus carrying the cross? Yeah. And so they're going up. Abraham builds an altar. He puts the wood in order and he binds Isaac, which, though the faith of Isaac is never mentioned in this, there had to have been a faith and a trust, whether it be in God or in his father. If Isaac's strong enough to carry the wood up the mountain, I, by this time probably, I would guess about 115 or so. He could have probably escaped, gotten away. But Abraham took the knife, and he was ready to slay him, and God stopped him. Abraham, Abraham. How often in the Bible do we see names doubled up like this? Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, don't do this. Now I know that you fear God. And what does Abraham look up and see at about this time? There was a ram caught in the thicket. And he became the burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called this place, the Lord will provide, or Yahweh Yireh, as the margin would say. And then God spoke again. And he repeats the blessing. He said, I know. In verse 16, by myself I have sworn. Why does God swear by himself? That's the highest power. There's no higher power to swear by. That's the point the Hebrew writer makes in chapter 6. But he says again, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to multiply your descendants. And you'll repeat so much of this. And then in verse 18, this is the clearest statement. This is the one quoted in Galatians 3:16. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Abraham obeyed God, and he made the offering, the seed promise is given, and then they go home. I can't imagine what it was like to be Isaac that day. What Abraham felt that day. And yet, what are we told about Abraham's feelings? At the very beginning, we're told, this is your son you love. I don't know what went through his mind, except what the Hebrew writer says is he believed God could raise him from the dead. And so he took him. Turn real quickly to James 2. We've got a lot I need to cover. But look at how James uses this in his faith and works chapter. Verse 21, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect or complete? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. That statement, Abraham believed God, that goes all the way back to Genesis 15. Before even Ishmael was born. And so we are, you know, I would guess 30 years or more after that. And he says, here's the proof of it. The statement he believed God was made, and it was true all those years. But then he says it was fulfilled. And then, you know, James, the second chapter, was not written to tell people how to become Christians. It was written to tell Christians how to act. Christians are to have faith and works. And yet, what I find interesting is he uses two human examples. He uses demons. That's a third illustration. But he uses Abraham. And he takes from Abraham a story of his faith 40 more years into the relationship with God. And he said that's faith and works. But who's the other one? Rahab. A woman who, prior to the spies coming, there's never had a relationship with God. I don't want to get too far off into the woods here, but what James 2 shows us is at the beginning of your relationship with God, you know what matters? Faith that obeys. Faith that works. When you've been serving God for 40 years, you know what matters? Faith that works. It's the same throughout. It's how you come to salvation. It's how you retain salvation. Did your hand go up?
Waiting for you to stop and say comments, but 1.5 more parallels. And I say half because it'll be implied. As Isaiah 53 tells us, the lamb led to the slaughter who opened not his mouth. We have 9 and 10. We have Isaac who just, okay, whatever you have to do, I'm here.
Yeah.
The other one, the half, when we read as humans, as people, as parents, dad, Where's the critter? Where's the sacrifice? God will provide. A lump in our throat. You wonder if God, as Abraham must have had choked back, did God do the same thing when Jesus was like right there as a parent?
Yeah, I don't know. God is so different from us, and yet he pictures himself to us as a father. And Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. You know, those are good thoughts. I don't know all the answers. But anybody else have any thought they want to add before we get a quickie here? Bethuel, you're reading along and it just came, somebody came and told Abraham, can you imagine? You know, they didn't pick up the phone. They didn't email him. But word gets to him that Milcah has borne children to your brother Nahor. And it starts naming them. And I love the first two names. I don't know if they're pronounced this way, but I always pronounced it Huz and Buzz because I just thought it sounded good. Maybe it's Who's and Booze. I don't know. But notice the total number of children, of sons. 12. You know, he's one of the ones, Nahor and Jacob all have 12. And the important one to this is Bethuel. Because Bethuel begets Rebekah. You know, the rest of these, they play no real role in the Bible story. But Bethuel is going to be really important to the story because of Rebekah. He'll also be important to the story because of a son he has that's not named here. Who's that going to be? Laban. Laban, he quite a character. Well, let's look quickly at chapter 23. It's an interesting story. You know, kind of the I mean, it's one of those that plays out kind of interesting. You see this negotiation of the, oh, you can have that land, knowing full well that Abraham's not going to take that land. And then it's like, what would 400 shekels be between, you know, kind of like, you know, it's worth 400, but I'm going to let you have it. And there's a certain drama. But why is the story here? Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, this story reminds again, Abraham knew this is not going to be the land during his lifetime. I mean, his wife dies. He doesn't own even a place to bury her. But it expresses, it's another way of showing us Abraham is confident that this one day will be the land of his family. I mean, what do we do when someone passes away? How many times they take them, we say, they're taking them back home to bury them. I mean, I look at sometimes the funeral notices here in Athens. There'll be somebody from Kansas. Why are they being buried here? Because they're taking them home. Does Abraham take Sarah back to Haran or to Ur? And you say, well, they couldn't do that back then. Joseph would say, I want my bones carried back. Jacob, before he died, he said, you take me back to Canaan. Abraham says, I want a place here. The land won't be ours yet, but I want a place here. And Sarah dies in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. That's where the arrow. And it says that Abraham came to mourn for her in verse 2. Perhaps it may suggest that he was off somewhere else at the time, but he mourns for her, he weeps, and then he goes to the sons of Heth, meaning the Hittites. Let me just give you a quick, right up in here near the Halley's River, that was the center of the Hittite power. You know, the Hittites had a very powerful kingdom up in that region. But they were not confined to it. We run into Hittites all along throughout the land of Canaan. And so, you know, they're, you know, these people are far removed from where the center of theirs is. But Abraham goes and he says, look, I need a place to bury my dead. And in verse 6, they said, look, you're a mighty prince, a prince of God. And you can use any one of our burial places. Great respect here, but there's also a possible thought here when they said, you can use any of our burial places. As Abraham's going to do, they buried more than one person in a tomb. You know, they would typically use a cave. They may have been saying, you know, we're not that interested in selling you anything, but, you know, you're welcome to use one of ours. But Abraham wanted something his own. And he names this Ephron. They negotiate. He gets the cave of Machpelah. And that's where he's going to bury Sarah, who is how old when she dies? 127. Now, you want to remember that number for several reasons. That's the only woman's age at death that we're given. You know, we're told how old a lot of men were when they died. Some have speculated that the women hedged on their age so much that they'd lost track, but that's somebody, that wasn't me that speculated on that. This is the only woman whose age at death, but it helps us in the next story when we talk about Isaac. But Sarah is buried after Abraham pays 400. And he gets not just a cave, he gets a field, and he has a place to bury his wife. And of course, he'll be buried there and several other members of the family. Anybody thoughts or questions, comments on this chapter? It's interesting. And I think these are some critical facts about it. But the human drama to me is interesting, but we're going to skip it to get to Isaac. Abraham's old. He'd be 37. So he's 37. Nope. He didn't leave that to him. I don't know why. Isaac is actually, when we come to chapter 24, what we learn later is 3 years have passed. And Isaac is now 40, which would make Abraham how old? 140. I want to go ahead and give you a little heads up if you haven't already noticed this before. In chapter 25, in verse 7, we'll read about the death of Abraham at 175. And then, after that, at verse 19 beginning, it'll tell about the births of Jacob and Esau. The boys were about 15 years old when Abraham died. Abraham, the writer, just finishes the story of Abraham, buries him, gets him out of the way, where he actually lives on into the lives of Jacob and Esau. But as far as the stories go, he's not important to that. So he's dispatched from it. Abraham is old. He's actually going to live 35 more years. But he realizes it's time. And he says to the oldest servant of his house, you know, back in chapter 15, that was Eliezer. That was a long time ago. It could have been somebody different. We're not given the name in this chapter, but I will tell you, the servant in this chapter is an impressive character. His faith, in prayer, the praise of God, the dedication of the mission. Abraham says, come on, I want you to take an oath. I want you to swear you will not take a wife from my son from whom? The Canaanites. He said, you go back to my family. Now, what did we read earlier about Terah and his family? They worshiped other gods, right? Do you remember jumping ahead? Those of you, I know we've studied before. What does Rachel do that upsets Laban when they flee? Stole the household idols. So, why is it, and Abraham is adamant, I do not want you to take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites. You go to my country, to my family. There you get her. And he's insistent. I think there are a couple of things to consider. All sin is bad. All sin can condemn. But some people are further along the path of sin than others. Sodom and Gomorrah received immediate destruction. He says the iniquity of the Canaanites is not yet complete. It's not yet time to destroy them. When Jeroboam will, you know, take over the divided kingdom and set up the golden calves, that's called sin more than once. But it was as far as sin goes, it was not nearly as bad as what Ahab and Jezebel did. It was an idolatrous worship of the Lord, which is wrong. And it may well be that in the family of Abraham, their idolatry didn't descend as low as the idolatry of the Canaanites. And it may also be that God has pronounced the doom on the Canaanites already. He said, in time, this will be your land when their iniquity is full. And so he just wants to emphasize the separation. Whatever the case, he said, not from these Canaanites. And he makes him swear to it. And he is adamant, you don't take my son back there. And so he loads up 10 camels and they depart. And they go to Nahor, the city of Nahor, meaning the city that Nahor lived in. Three different finding wives stories take place at wells. The next two will involve heroic action by the man. You know, Jacob will, you know, he'll help out Rachel. Moses, he will help out the daughters of Zipporah. But in this case, he comes, he has his camels kneel down. And then you notice verse 12, he prays to the Lord, to Jehovah. He said, I'm by this well of water. And typically the women were the ones that fetched the water. And he said, the daughters of the city are coming out and I'm going to ask. He's praying to God. He said, I'm going to ask for a drink of water. You know, a lot of young ladies would give a drink of water to a stranger. But he said, if there is one that says, I'll not just give you a drink, but I will water your camels. Let that be the one. How many camels does he have? 10. How much can a camel drink? If they're thirsty, if they have been without water, they can take sometimes 30 gallons. You know, if they're not that thirsty, they may only drink about 15. That's quite a task. She's going to be going in with that pitcher a bunch of times. Well, here she comes. And notice, he said, I mean, he had not even finished this prayer. And here comes Rebecca, who was born to Bethuel, whose family. Now, he doesn't know this, but what he knows, verse 16, is she is very beautiful to behold. A virgin. Likely, or at least we know later on in the time of David, the virgin daughters, the unmarried, wore a different type of clothing. Maybe her clothing marked her as unmarried. And he ran up and met her and said, could you let me have a little water? She gives him water and then she says, look, I'll water your camels. Well, he's still not sure. Look at verse 21. He's remaining silent. And when the camels finish drinking, he breaks out the jewelry. Got a couple of bracelets, a nose ring. And as he tells it later, he finds out that she's family before he puts them on her. But he presents her with a couple of bracelets, gives her a nose ring. And now, he doesn't tell her yet what the plan is. He just says, is there lodging in your father's house? And she said, oh, sure, we'll have straw and feed enough. You know, we can take care of you and your camels. Verse 26, he bowed his head and worshiped the Lord. He praised God. He believes he's accomplished his mission. Verse 28, don't miss this. The young woman ran and told her mother's household. We read, you know, I mean, we know that so often there were more than one wife, there were concubines, her mother's household. That would seem to imply that this is a family that's got more than, she doesn't tell her family, she tells her mother's household, and her father's still alive. Well, she also has a brother named Laban, who will become really important later on in the story, and when we come to Jacob. Laban is very gracious in this chapter. But I tend to think that Moses, the writer, is planting a seed here in verse 30. When he saw the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, when he sees this gold, he goes running down to this man that's got 10 camels loaded with wealth. And he invites this man in. Evidently, Bethuel may be aging, because Laban just seems to take the lead through all of this. And they bring him in, and the servant, and I like this, verse 32, he took care of the camels, made sure they were taken care of. But when they set food down, he said, no, I'm not eating. He said, I've got a mission. I've got to tell you about my mission. And he retells the whole story. And if you don't think this story is important, why does he repeat all these details in a book that sometimes can just skip over years? The servant goes back over almost every detail. And he lets them know, Abraham's been blessed greatly. You know, he's about to say, I want you to send your young daughter off, you know, down there to this kinsman. Well, he makes clear, we're asking you to send your daughter down, daughter and sister in the case of Laban, to a guy who's really wealthy. And Isaac's the only heir. You know, he makes it clear, you know, she's going to get it all. You know, she's going to be a part of all of this. And he tells about the prayer that he had prayed and how all of these things have played out. And I mean, he just repeats the whole thing. And in verse 50, Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Lord. We cannot speak to you either bad or good. This is like saying we don't have a choice in this. How can we not believe this is the Lord? And they said, you know, let her go be your master's son's wife. You know, we will take these 10 camel loads of goods. You know, that seems like a fair price. And that's really what that amounts to. That they did very well. And so, and just kind of think ahead, I'm plant the seed again. Abraham sends 10 camels loaded down as a bride price for Isaac's wife. Jacob arrives a few years later, a lot of years later actually, about 97 years later, with a staff in his hand. There's a big difference. That's why he ends up working all those years. Have I ever told y'all I hate bells? No. Sunday, we will finish. We just got a few little details, and then we will bury Abraham, move on into the story of Isaac, and get into the blessing of Jacob.